coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Spring arrived this week, and that means it's time to get back in the garden, including community gardens.
Gardening is one of those great common interests, and it is an opportunity for people to connect with folks who share their values, and that includes helping others.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida examines community gardening in the First State. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about the U.S. Ag Department's updated plant hardiness zone map and what it means for Delaware. Arts Playlist takes us to a new Jamie Wyeth exhibition. And Enlighten Me explains the growing popularity of non-alcoholic drinks. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a First State of Mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Spring officially arrived this week, and with it, the opportunity for many to get out in the yard and plant a garden. But many are not limiting themselves to that backyard garden. Community gardens are growing in the First State, offering benefits you can't get going it alone. This week, contributor Eileen Dalabrida takes a closer look at community gardens in her latest piece at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me this week to discuss what she learned. Let's start with the basic premise of a community garden. What does a typical community garden look like? What does it grow? What are people looking at if they're looking at a community garden?
Well, most often you'll find raised beds, 4 feet by 8 feet. And even these small plots produce lots of veggies. Some gardens ask the gardeners to pay an annual fee, maybe $50, $75, while others are free. And there is a wide variety in what you grow. You might put in cut flowers for arrangements at your church, strawberries to eat fresh or to make jam, tomatoes that you might can and enjoy all winter. Herbs, which are expensive in the grocery store, are extremely popular. And it's also a great opportunity to experiment with bok choy or Swiss chard, the veggies that might not be a regular on your menu.
So these gardens oftentimes are very popular in urban areas, correct? I mean, places where you may not have the space to grow your own garden at home, there's now a space where you can go to and do this kind of gardening.
Yes. There are 28 gardens in the city of Wilmington alone, ranging from gardens established on abandoned parking lots to small urban farms. As an example, Conscious Connections, which is devoted to educational programs, created an urban farm on abandoned lots in Brandywine Village. And that's where young people can learn about agriculture through its Young Master Gardeners program.
But these gardens are not limited to urban areas. There are some gardens elsewhere. Can you tell us about where some other places you found urban gardens when you were reporting the story? It sounds like they are kind of all over the state and in obviously varieties of sizes.
Oh, yeah. There's a very small garden on Delaware State University's campus in Dover. Employees at a distribution center planted a garden at work. And small town Milford has an active garden. They have popped up all over.
So, did any of the community gardens you had a chance to learn about stand out to you as something that maybe you didn't expect to see from a community garden?
They do. Gardens do seem to have their own particular flavor. In Lewis, the focus is on organic gardening. Planting to Feed in Wilmington is committed to feeding people who don't have enough to eat. It seems that gardeners and gardens are usually kind of find their way to form a good match.
Is it hard to start a community garden or to join one? There's a lot of them. They're different sizes. But for a person who's trying to find out or figure out where they can get involved, how hard is it to do that?
Well, it isn't as easy as plunking down a couple tomato plants in your backyard, but becoming involved in a community garden is not difficult. A good place to start is simply to look for a garden near you at a church or a community center Or you might want to ask for advice at your local garden center. The State Extension Service is a great resource, and they operate demonstration gardens in all three counties where folks can learn about everything from learning to grow berries to making compost.
And I guess one thing you should also bring with you is a bit of a commitment, right? I mean, if you're going to be part of a community garden, it's probably something you don't necessarily maybe dabble in. You actually kind of you kind of jump in both feet.
Roll up your sleeves.
You mentioned the community extension folks. Often these gardens do get some type of assistance. What are some of the other resources that these gardens have tapped into to get up and running and grow?
Well, in the DSU garden I mentioned previously, volunteers there work under the guidance of a master gardener coordinator in Kent County. The Newcastle County Conservation District provides community grants of up to $3,000 so that gardens can really have a good infrastructure, such as rain barrels, irrigation systems, tool sheds, and fencing.
I was going to say, there's a lot of benefits to gardening as a whole for anybody. But with community gardens, there is kind of more than just the, hey, I grew some food that I can use in my own kitchen. Tell us a little about some of the other benefits that you've heard from people about community gardens and how people can really make a difference by being part of one.
Well, they're really, you really do benefit from a community. There are often shared tools which are there in your shed. You typically, you have a water supply. Most gardens are fenced, which keeps out deer, who can be quite a problem in home gardens. Although I'm told the fences are not that effective against bunnies. You can share, which is a big aspect. One gardener has an abundance of compost. Somebody else has seedlings to share. There's an important exchange of knowledge. You might learn how to can tomatoes or how to get rid of pests without chemicals by putting in a few plants that bugs don't like, such as marigolds.
And I was going to say, there's also kind of the benefits outside of the garden itself, right? A lot of these gardens wind up with surplus food. A lot of them are also kind of, helping in terms of pollinator issues. I mean, there is a lot. I mean, these gardens actually have more reach than maybe people might expect, right?
Absolutely.
And I guess you mentioned some of these ideas of working together with people. And I suppose that may be the biggest part of these gardens, right, is that they do bring people together. What did you hear from people about that aspect of getting involved in a community garden and it being more than just growing plants, that it really did do something for community?
Well, people make friends with people with whom they share common interests, and gardening is one of those great common interests. And it is an opportunity for people to connect with folks who share their values, and that includes helping others, donating nutritious produce to people who don't have ready access to healthy foods, whether that be a small distribution box or supplying hundreds of pounds of produce each year to a pantry or a soup kitchen. It's an opportunity to help other people.
And obviously, that's the community part of community gardens is actually getting people together in a time when sometimes people tend to be polarized. It's nice to see that people can come together around something and actually not only just get some food for themselves, but to accomplish some big things.
Yeah, it's very basic.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time on the Green this week. Her piece on community gardens is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We continue prepping you for the spring planting season with a look at the updated U.S. Department of Agriculture Plant Hardiness Zone map and what it means for Delaware gardeners. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Last segment, we highlighted community gardens in the First State, but many of you may want to flex your green thumbs in your own backyard, and we're here to help with that, too. Before you buy your seeds, it's important to note that for the first time since 2012, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has updated its Plant Hardiness Zone map, which helps gardeners know what to plant and where to garden. The new map reflects rising temperature trends. The new map reflects rising temperature trends, with Delaware largely in a new zone with warmer temperatures. Overall, the new map is about 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the old map across the United States. Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry sat down this week with Olivia DiFilippo, Horticulture Manager at the Delaware Center for Horticulture, to learn more about the new Plant Hardiness Zone map and gardening this year in the First State.
Olivia, we've seen a bit of a cold snap here in the area recently, but spring has indeed sprung. It officially started this week, and that means gardeners are warming up their shovels and rakes, and this year brings a new twist with the updated plant hardiness map from the USDA. But before we get to that, what are the most important things people can do right now to prep their garden for the rising spring temperatures and the spring season? Like cleaning up the yard, raking leaves, cleaning the drains, you know, stuff like that.
Sure. So it seems like this is the week where our part of the land is getting our second winter. Usually this time of year, spring starts and it comes, but we usually get another cold snap. Typically for garden prep and especially for cutbacks, you want to wait until we have five days of at least 50 degree weather. That gives time for our beneficial insects and native bees to leave where they're in their diapause, or what is their hibernation period. So lots of times, like for example, in perennials, you could have a hollow stalk from last year's growth. Bees will actually burrow into those stalks and they sleep there in the winter. So if you cut back your perennials too early or cut back your crops, you could be quite literally throwing away beneficial insects and bees. So that's number one thing that I always look for, is that 5 days of 50 degree weather. You mentioned leaf cleanup. So here at the DCH and in my own personal practice, we like to say leave the leaves. So leaves are a great natural compost, natural mulch. You know, if mulching's not for you, don't do your yard cleanup. You can save those leaves. You can chop them into a finer material and use that as your mulch, and which will essentially just degrade back into the earth and provide nutrients for the plants that are in your garden. So we like to leave the leaves here. We haven't started mulching yet. Mulching really comes after we install. If we're adding new plants, we'll mulch afterwards. And we try and use arbor mulch as much as possible, or leaf litter for mulch versus dyed mulches. The arbor mulch degrades at a really nice pace and leaves a lot of nutrients in the soil. So if you live in an urban site, or you know, have had your soil tested and it doesn't have the nutrient profile that you want, arbor mulch can help kind of restore your media or your soil. A big one for everyone at this time is weed eradication. We're really working on weeding a lot, trying to get our native weeds under control, which is always a struggle. And any gardener will probably say the same thing. We've done a little bit of seed starting, too, now that it's getting warmer out.
Now, this next question, it might have an obvious answer, but what are the most ideal conditions for gardening in the spring, and what do those look like in this region?
So a lot of folks will say you want to wait until after Mother's Day to plant your veggies outside. Some things, however, can be planted before or after your last frost date. Some veggies, like your brassicas, spinach, greens, they can benefit from a little bit of cold weather. It actually helps your crop taste sweeter, have a little bit more flavor if they do get a cold snap. So depending on what you're planting, the cold might help your crop. Yeah, typically just in between your last frost date and Mother's Day. After Mother's Day is typically when folks will start planting their annuals. Garden centers get really busy. And now that we've moved from 7A to 7B, I'm anxious to see what kind of changes we'll come across this growing season and see how that change of the hardiness zone map affects our area.
If you've been a gardener in Delaware long enough, you might have noticed the conditions and the environment changing around you, and that was confirmed with the USDA recently updating their plant hardiness zone map, which shows rising temperatures trends and basically serves as a guide for gardeners so they know what to plant and where to garden. Delaware is almost entirely in a new zone with warmer temperatures. So what do you make of that, Olivia, and how exactly does that factor into gardening plans?
Most gardeners should be familiar with creating sun maps for your yard or your site where you're going to plant. And that's just kind of making visual maps of how much sun your area gets per day, how many hours. And that's how you would kind of start to plan. But with that change in hardiness zone, I think we'll see an increase. I think we'll definitely see an increase in weed pressure this year just from the early weather, it warming up a lot earlier. It started getting warm around here at least a few weeks ago. It's been signs of spring for quite a while now. And folks I've been talking to have mentioned how like early perennials are popping up and early they're seeing buds on trees. So I think we'll start to see crops kind of waking up from their dormancy and starting their spring growth a lot earlier. Which could in turn cause some confusion because around here we do get those second cold snaps. So, a few worries that I have are for our pollinators, if folks are doing cutbacks too early, raking and throwing away your leaf litter is essentially throwing away pollinators and bees. So, I'm worried for our pollinators with this change in hardiness zone. I don't think it will affect what we're able to grow in our area that much because it hasn't. Although the change was drastic for USDA to change the hardiness zone map, I don't think it's drastic enough for us to have to really modify what we're able to grow in this area. I mean, we still can't grow tropicals. No one's going to be able to grow monsteras in their backyard or pothos up their trees. We're certainly not warm like Florida is, but I think spring is going to start coming earlier now. So folks will have to start their garden prep a little earlier in the coming years.
Pivot and dig a little deeper into gardening specifics. If you're in the brainstorming stage, how do you plan out your garden? You've mentioned the importance of sunlight, but where should you start with planning?
Oh man, well, I think that can vary person to person and site to site. If you're gardening at home, I suggest choosing an area that gets ample sunlight through the day, but also some afternoon shade. I would suggest an area that has adequate moisture. So I would not start a vegetable garden, for example, on a hill or a sloped area. Or a sunken in area that might hold rainwater. You kind of want the flattest area of your yard that gets the most sun and a bit of shade. If you're starting fresh, I would just go with plants that you like. A lot of gardening comes with its research. You have to be willing to put in the research about the plants you want to cultivate. It's really difficult to grow something and not know its growth pattern. And that's how people's gardens get wild and out of control. And I think lots of folks are looking for that more like maintained look. I would definitely start by getting a soil test, which the University of Delaware's Department of Agriculture does do free soil testing. So they're a great resource to have. You definitely want to get a soil test first. And they'll be able to tell you all the components of your media and your NPK ratios, if you need to add an amendment, if you need to, fix your alkalinity or your pH, they could suggest that to you as well. So that's where I always like to start is testing my soil. That's definitely number one, picking a good site and testing your soil.
There are also always questions out there concerning pests and insects eating up plants. What advice do you have for listeners trying to go natural?
Oh, sure. So host plants are key to having a successful garden. For example, marigolds are an aphid magnet. So if you want to keep aphids off your, I don't know, your tomatoes or aphids off your plants, if you companion plant with marigolds, other florals, some herbs, will deter common garden pests. Because you certainly don't want to use any chemical applications on vegetables, anything you're going to consume. I would stay away from chemical control and just go with more biological and mechanical control, which would be more like physical, like weed removal. You can focus on your natural predators. So, for example, a large issue in vegetable gardening is the tomato hornworm. Pycnanthemum or mountain mint is a magnet for, and I can't tell you exactly what species of wasp it is. It's slipping my mind right now, but there's a species of wasp, parasitic wasp, that will basically infect the tomato hornworm with eggs, and the eggs will grow out of the hornworm. So for example, last year around my tomatoes, I planted some mountain mint, and the mountain mint attracted the natural predator for the tomato hornworm. So I didn't have to do any, you know, manual removal. I didn't even think about it. My mountain mint was taking care of my tomatoes. And that's just one benefit to companion planting. But I would definitely say to folks to do research on what plants can benefit you in your garden, not just plants that you want to eat or consume.
And in terms of watering, and this is a two-part question, how much does the kind of water matter? For example, tap water versus filtered water. And how should we water the plants? Bottom up or top down? Does it depend on the plant?
Typically, you shouldn't have to water your garden much if we're getting adequate rainfall. If we have another drought, like a 6-week drought like we did last year, folks are definitely going to have to lay down water on their gardens and their properties. Plants that are planted in the ground, in the earth, shouldn't need as much water as container plants do, right? Because your adventitious roots can really scoot away from the plant and find that water that they're looking for. And in the ground, your plants have an opportunity to grow a more vigorous root system than they do in a container. If we're talking about containers, a myth that I'd love to bust is you can't just check your plants every Monday and Friday. You know, if you're a dedicated container gardener, you should be checking your containers every day, if not twice a day, to see how much they're drinking, how much sun they're getting, and how much water they need. Another myth I'd like to bust is bottom-up irrigation. That's actually really detrimental to your plants in containers, because especially if you're fertilizing your container plants, if you don't get that leachate, that runoff that runs out of your container, you're risking salt buildup in your pots, in your containers, which can cause nutrient lockout for your crops. So bottom watering can do a lot more harm than it can good. So I definitely suggest top-down irrigation and checking your containers often. This is another situation where I highly suggest researching the plants you're buying, how they grow, and what conditions they prefer.
Thanks to Olivia DiFilippo, Horticulture Manager at the Delaware Center for Horticulture, and our Joe Irizarry for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where we head to the Brandywine Conservancy and Museum of Art for a preview of the new Jamie Wyeth exhibit there. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. After 5 years of planning, the Jamie Wyeth Unsettled exhibition makes its debut at the Brandywine Conservancy and Museum of Art. Unsettled showcases more than 50 fascinating and somewhat disconcerting paintings from throughout Jamie Wyeth's career. And for this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Quinn Kirkpatrick and Kyle McKinnon visited the Brandywine for a preview of Jamie Wyeth Unsettled, with Wyeth and Brandywine Museum of Art Senior Curator Amanda Burden.
Well, so looking at the body of Jamie's work, and I got great access to his database, to his photographs, to images from his entire career, and I started picking out, maybe it was just personal, but it was ways in which his work made me personally feel unsettled. And along the years, I started devising these categories of people that made me feel uneasy because they were either turned away from me or staring straight at me, and I felt like I was being watched. I felt like I was being accused of something, caught doing something. There were sections, there were works where the natural world turned supernatural. Trees especially seemed to come to life. Different aspects of the animal world were elevated to kind of mythic status. And then there were also works where I thought, you know, this is in the vein of a traditional haunted house, or this feeling that you walk into a place and you're like, something's not quite right here. I mean, to me, that's a very cinematic approach, because there's establishing shots in movies where, you know, bad things are going to happen in this scene, or bad things are going to happen in that house. A lot of times I felt like, looking at your paintings, I was nervous about what comes next in the narrative.
Just to show you, it's not just based on tales and sort of supernatural stuff. I did this painting in a much smaller size 30 years ago, I think. And I noticed this tree along the Brandywine, somehow it hung on. And I thought, oh my God, I've got to go back and really sort of study it even more. And it happened to be in the property of Frolic Weymouth, who started this museum. And so to me, it really is a portrait of Frolic. I mean, there is a portrait of Frolic, which is in this museum. But this is really, and the uncanny thing is, I went and sat in my Jeep and literally painted it on the spot, this huge thing. The day I finished it, it fell over.
Wow.
It completely disappeared.
And there's the supernatural.
Yes. But that actually happened.
Yes. I didn't know that story about Frolic. And yeah. I mean, now Frolic, I mean.
And he had just died.
Yeah, I was going to say. And
so
now
the whole thing was just.
You were mentioning the other night at the film screening, you live with a lot of ghosts.
Yeah.
And they keep you well fed with the subject
Absolutely.
Matter as well.
And not in the form of humans, always.
So. Well, I mean, it matches up. You were talking earlier about, you know, not really liking people in your studio, but there are a lot of spirits there,
yes,
anyway.
That's for sure. So, and most of my paintings really are done not with me sitting in front of an easel and with paint. They're done in bed at night, dreaming. I always keep a pad on my bed because I wake up in the middle of the night and start drawing things sometimes. And in the morning when I wake up, there's all this like leaves everywhere. And they're all kind of hieroglyphics. You really can't tell what the hell it is. But then I have the fascination trying to figure out, what was I thinking about? And a lot of paintings have come out of just that process.
You know, it's being described, I mean, it's being presented as creepy, unsettling. With all your work in here, when you were working on those pieces and when you saw the finished product, were those some of the feelings that they elicited in yourself when you saw what you did? And how do you think that this exhibition captures what you felt when you originally did these paintings?
Well, what Amanda's done is to reveal secrets of mine. I mean, obviously I was aware of some of it, but I did not intend these things to be creepy or to be get chills up people's spines. But clearly that was part of the impetus. It wasn't all of it, but part of it. And oftentimes, it was the most important part of it, but it was couched where it wasn't like a glaring point, oh look, isn't this scary? Isn't this a terrifying looking person, and so forth. So I'm fascinated by any reaction that people get. It always astounds me. But also thrills me when they don't get it.
I think it's part of, I'll say, your vital nature, that this is a side of you, so it's natural that it appears in some of your artworks. Sometimes it takes the lead role, sometimes it's quiet in the corner.
Sure.
And
but it's undercurrents all over.
Yeah. You said something really interesting about when how the exhibit process can be a little jarring at times because you're seeing all the, at least the imperfections you see, you know, jump out at you. And I'm just really curious about that. When you're working on a given piece, how do you get past that part of imperfection? You know, something great and imperfect is obviously better than, you know, never being being released is better than something that never gets released at all. And it's still, you know, great and imperfect. But how do you get past that process of perfectionism and when you know something is ready to, you know, be on the
screen? That's always a hard thing for me to decide because it's usually I reach a point of diminishing return. When I'm working on something, I become completely obsessed with it. So I kind of drain myself on that, and if the imperfections are there, let them be there. But and the ones I destroy are just ones that I think are not very imperfect or something, or they just didn't work, or you know something bothers me about it. But I always feel with a painting, once it leaves me, it has its own life. And some of the things that come out from people who think what my interpretation was, I remain silent. I just sort of nod and say, "You're right," you know. But it it requires a lot.
Like when it comes to when you're like doing something together like this, and like it's a lot of, you know, just has been seen before and whatnot. What are like the biggest like obstacles in that, as opposed to like a more straightforward exhibit might be?
Some of it is finding these things all again because he's made some of them 40, 50, 60 years ago. And so it's sort of like, where is that in the world? And that's a real detective hunt to try and track down who owned it. Now, who did they give it to? Who's their kids? What state do they live in? So that's a bizarre challenge that I think makes a curator a detective in a lot of ways.
And again, the timeline again is 5 years.
So the earliest email that I think I have about this is January 2019, where I say I've already put together the checklist. So we were definitely working on it. In 2013, I wrote an essay where I talked about his unsettled paintings, and I've been thinking about it since then. In 2008, I worked on another exhibition at another museum, and Jamie Wyeth wrote the introduction. And he wrote, the title of that introduction was The Ghost of Rockwell Kent and Me. And so I said, this guy likes ghosts? That's kind of cool, you know, and I've been thinking about that introduction of being an artist who talks about how he works with ghosts over his shoulder and you know, communing with the dead. So I've been on that track for a long time.
Thanks to artist Jamie Wyeth and Brandywine Museum of Art Senior Curator Amanda Burden for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist, along with our Quinn Kirkpatrick and Kyle McKinnon. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn more about why more people are turning to a zero-proof lifestyle with non-alcoholic drinks. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. St. Patrick's Day was last weekend, and if you went out to celebrate, you may have noticed more non-alcoholic drink options on the menu. And that's not a coincidence. It's a growing movement. More people are cutting back on their alcohol consumption in favor of a zero-proof lifestyle. Restaurants and bars are adding non-alcoholic drinks and mocktails to their menus, with big brands like Heineken and Guinness now including non-alcoholic options in their lineups. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon discusses the growth of non-alcoholic drinks with spirits and hospitality writer Elva Ramirez, author of Zero Proof, 90 Non-Alcoholic Recipes for Mindful Drinking.
Elva, I'm sure you've heard some of this talk, but many are saying that this time we're living in right now in 2024, this is the golden age, or the so-called golden age, for NAs, non-alcoholic drinks, be it beer, wine, whiskey, tequila, what have you. We've obviously come a long way, but I'm curious why you think this is all happening right now for non-alcoholic drinks and this overall non-alcoholic movement, this lifestyle and the acceptance of it. Why is right now the moment for NAs?
There's multiple reasons for it, but the top, the sort of the headline that I would give you is choice. So for the first time in a long time, I would say first time ever, really, someone who doesn't want to drink has so many more choices of like that are quality choices, that are adult choices. By adult, I mean they have sophisticated palates, like they have bitterness, they have mouthfeel, they have depth of flavor, they have a lot of complexity to them. It's not just juice. And so that's one reason why the consumer is interested in this. The consumer is very consumer driven. And as a result, we're getting a lot of really great products that have hit the market. There's been a little bit of a boom in non-alcoholic products that are set up for someone who likes cocktails. That's an interesting, you know, that's a very important distinction.
There's some of that I want to drill down into, but just for a quick moment here, let's take a step back. You published the book Zero Proof, 90 Non-Alcoholic Recipes for Mindful Drinking. You published that in 2021. So, you know, your time in this NA space, so to speak, how have you seen attitudes, you know, in a social sense, change around non-alcoholic drink options and those who are choosing to live this NA lifestyle?
You know, what's interesting is that while this feels very new, and it's certainly new in terms of the fact that we now have options in terms of products, and we now have an awareness in terms of hospitality, this is not a new idea at all, actually. So the non-alcoholic drink is gone through different names, but it is as old as the original cocktail. So in 1862, Jerry Thomas published the first recipe cocktail book as we know it. And that is the Bible for cocktail culture, in that, you know, you have recipes for the mint julep, for example. So it's the foundation for everything that comes after in terms of cocktail. There are temperance drinks. They're called temperance drinks. There are temperance drinks in that book. So the non-alcoholic cocktail has been with us since the beginning. What's different now, as I mentioned, is the fact that we now have really great products that are not simple, that are complex and that are interesting to drink, and that try to mimic some of the complexity or depth of flavor of a traditional cocktail or a boozy cocktail, I should say.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting concept. It seems, you know, the correlation seems fairly obvious. Better non-alcoholic options leads to more people buying them and growth and all that. So again, that correlation would seem fairly apparent, but are we seeing that across all different kinds here, whether it's, you mentioned mocktails, beer, wine? It seems like some have grown faster than others. How does it break down across the specific kinds of non-alcoholic options?
It's growing so fast, it's hard to say right now, but I think beer was really one of the early, you know, non-alcoholic beer has been with us for a very long time. Right. And I would say that it didn't have the best reputation for many years, but now, because of certain knowledge in terms of distilling, and it's now really kind of as comparable, it delivers as much as the same flavor as in terms of distilling as a traditional beer. And there's been a lot of investment in the non-alcoholic category by major players like Anheuser-Busch, Heineken, Carlsberg. They're seeing a lot of sales in this. I think wine, if you're asking like who's ahead of it, I would put cocktails next. Wine's still a little bit lagging. I think there hasn't anyone who's really sort of solved the wine issue yet. It's coming along though. But I think cocktail culture, and with certainly the advent of Seedlip, which has really kind of just changed everything, which I think came out in 2016. Seedlip kind of basically introduced a brand new category, which is the idea of a non-alcoholic distillate or a non-alcoholic spirit. So something that's non-alcoholic, but you treat it and you treat it like a spirit, and you make cocktails with it in the same way. And that, when you talk about the changing attitudes, the introduction of Seedlip changed the way, it opened the door and created a whole new category for how people are thinking about the non-alcoholic occasion in a bar. Because the non-alcoholic beer had been around, but it wasn't until we had these non-alcoholic spirits. And I say, and you know, the spirits is, we can argue about whether it's a spirit or not, but it's made in the same process as a spirit. They just sort of stop at the stage before alcohol is created. So there's, you know, it's made in stills and all that. When Seedlip came around and bartenders at the world's top bars started using these ingredients, these spirits, that changed everything. That was really where the difference is. And all of a sudden there's a lot more interest in it, and a lot. And as a result, we get a lot more startups and a lot more products that come in that make it that you can go into a bar and order a beautiful drink, and it's still going to look as you know, elegant as the martini next to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the cost of these drinks then? I'm fairly, we spoke off air before this. I'm fairly aware of the pricing today. You know, I've bought, non-alcoholic beer and wine actually just recently for some occasions. But how has the price tag changed as NAs have got more popular, or is it fairly like similar to normal alcohol? What does that pricing look like now?
I'm going to say it's comparable. And there's a lot of resistance within the consumer to pay as much for a non-alcoholic. Let's say, for example, if a cocktail in New York City costs $18, if you put a non-alcoholic cocktail and also price it at $18, you'll find resistance within the consumer for that because there's a couple of different reasons for that. The consumers have been trained to think that the alcohol is the most expensive and valuable ingredient in a cocktail. That's not necessarily true, because at really top bars, what you're really paying for is everything that happens before you get to the bar. So you're paying for the bartenders and the back of house staff to make really great tinctures, to do really cool things with the fruits, right? To really transform the fruit into something else, whether it's a syrup, whether they're making a carbonation, a carbonated soda. There's a lot of work that's happening, and also fruit and vegetables are very expensive. So you're not actually just paying for alcohol. You're paying for all the labor that happens behind it. So in many ways, the non-alcoholic drink can cost in terms of labor, if not more, than the traditional drink, because now you're using even more fresh drinks, fresh ingredients. And so you're paying for the labor. You're not just paying for the ingredients itself. You are paying for the ingredients, but you're also paying for all the process that happens before you sit down at the bar.
You mentioned choice earlier, control and choice, essentially that ilk. But there are a variety of reasons people are turning to non-alcoholic drink options, whether they're going sober or they're already sober. Perhaps there are nutritional reasons. Maybe you just want a lifestyle change. There's also the social aspect to it. But what are you hearing as far as why people, you know, does that line up? Is it a variety of things? It depends on the person. What are you hearing? What are you seeing on that score in terms of the reasons people are turning to these NAs?
There's a couple different reasons for that, but the sort of top line reason I always give in terms of why this is trending now is that when you look at the food and beverage as a category, beverage is lagging behind food. So the trends that we see in food will eventually come into beverage. And so I always link the popularity of the alternative diets, keto and gluten-free and veganism, low carbs, all the things that people have been trained that they want as choices. Now they're seeing that because they want those choices, they want now the same choices in what they drink, right? So the popularity of oat milk, for example, the popularity of some of these alt meats, many of the consumers who drink oat milk also drink milk. And a lot of the consumers who, you know, drink some or eat some of the impossible foods also eat meat. So it's that a consumer wants variety and a consumer wants choice.
You know, Elva, as we near the finish line, I want to know what you might recommend for someone who's interested in giving this a go and trying a non-alcoholic option or two. Where should that person start?
The good news is that there's been so many products that are out that you now have a choice that when I started writing this book, there weren't a lot of products. I actually added a few at the very end because they had just debuted just as I was turning in my manuscript. Like that's how new some of these products are. So one, if you like cocktails, if you want something to replicate a whiskey sour, for example, you can start by saying, I want to make a version of a traditional drink. That's one way to start. I want to start with a non-alcoholic whiskey sour, for example. There's a company called Ritual. They're out of Chicago. They are absolutely fantastic. And they have a line of fake gin, fake whiskey, and fake tequila that you can then use as a substitute for traditional gin. They are fantastic. But then there's another way you can go where it's something that's has a complexity of flavor that's maybe not, it doesn't quite exist in the traditional alcoholic world, but it's a whole new flavor. And for them, I always recommend Everleaf. They're out of London. They came to the States about, I think last year, maybe, or a year and a half ago. They have different expressions that you can use in your cocktails. It's designed by someone who's a botanist. So it really has a real of just wonderful awareness of flavor and mouthfeel. And then last, if you want sodas, Casamara Club out of Brooklyn, they make sparkling Amaro sodas. They're absolutely fantastic. And then St. Agresti's, I think also out of Brooklyn, makes Phony Negronis, which I prefer to their bottled Phony Negronis, which I prefer to their traditional Negronis.
Thanks to spirits and hospitality writer Elva Ramirez and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Joey Irizarry and Quinn Kirkpatrick, and our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.